Now, how can we be sure that this is so? Well, there are many ways in which we can begin to develop this. I've tried to make it clear that companionship is the basic element. And I will come back to that companionship theme in a few moments. But I'd like now just to turn for a moment to the idea of engagement in the Bible. You know, we have a false concept of engagement that we read back into the Scriptures from our modern practices. Engagement in our day is officially going steady for many people. It's engagement is when you can afford to buy the ring, but she may give it back, or you may ask for it back, or whatever. There is nothing really binding about an engagement in our society. It's just kind of a visible way of going steady for a lot of people. Engagements are broken as easily as though there were no ring at all involved. Now, that's not true in the Bible. Never is that the picture, never is that to be read back into the Scriptures. That was not the culture, and that's not the way that the Scriptures speak or think of marriage and engagement. Betrothal, or giving your trust, troth, trust, are related. Plighting a troth is to pledge your trust, your truth, your trust, your faith, your faithfulness. Was a very binding thing. In fact, it was a covenantal thing, which we shall see. And the fact is that an engagement entered into brought with it, if the person entered into illicit sexual relations with another party during that engaged period, brought with it the death penalty, rather than the penalty that was brought to a person who simply was not engaged and was a free, single individual, which was the penalty for sexual sin, but not the kind of sexual sin that was adultery. It brought a lesser punishment. But an engaged or a betrothed woman or who got involved in sexual relations was stoned to death. We can read about this in Deuteronomy 22. Let's see. Verses 24. Where are we here now? Well, let's start at 23. When a man comes upon a girl in the city who is a virgin betrothed to another, and he lies with her, you shall bring them both to the gate of the city and stone them to death. The girl, because she did not cry out, see, this is in the city, although the city was all about her, and the man, because he violated his neighbor's wife. Now, of course, in the rape classes today, they tell the girl not to call out. Our society, presumably, is a little bit different from that society in which people cared about other people and they became engaged rather than disengaged. Very interesting that we have different advice in our day being given because of the terrible lack of concern for one another. You shall purge such evil from among you. But if the man comes upon the betrothed girl in the open field and seizes her to lie with her, then the man alone shall die. But you must do nothing to the girl, for there is no sin in her deserved death, for it is as when a man attacks his neighbor and murders him. The man found her in the open country. The betrothed girl cried out for help, but there was no one to hear him. Now, if, however, a man comes upon a girl who is a virgin and not betrothed, and lays hold upon her and lies with her, and they are discovered, then the man must pay her father 50 silver dollars, and she shall become his wife, because he has dishonored her, and he shall not divorce her all his day. Sounds like an awful thing to happen to the girl, doesn't it? Well, I think we have to read in the light of Exodus 22:16, which further qualifies that question. Exodus 22:16 says, if a man seduces a virgin to whom he is not engaged and cohabits with her, he must without fail pay her dowry and marry her. But if her father steadfastly refuses to let him have her, then the man must weigh out the cash equivalent to the dowry of virgins. So I think there was a we have to read that other passage in the light of it. This is just a simple reference to that fuller passage. And it doesn't give all the particulars. Certainly the father had a discretionary role to play in this thing. This didn't take away the father's ability to still make that decision. And he would make his decision in the light, certainly, of her desire in this matter in any case. So it's not quite as bad as it at first sounds. But you notice the point that I'm making, that the one who's betrothed and in the city, where she could have gotten help, where it's presumed that she could have gotten help, and she did not call for help, that woman is put to death, you see. But the one who is not betrothed, she's not put to death. And so we have quite a different role for the two. Betrothal itself brings about the same penalty as if that girl were married. Look at verse 22 here in Deuteronomy 23. When a man is surprised abed with a married woman, they shall both die. The man who lay with a woman and the woman too, you shall wipe out the evil from Israel. So exactly the same penalty. They are viewed in exactly the same light. They are viewed as though married. As a matter of fact, you have in passages such as 2 Samuel 3:14, this interesting kind of thing, where David says to Saul, David then sent messengers to Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, demanding, give me my wife to whom I became engaged. He's calling her a wife already after the engagement. And she was viewed as his wife. The covenant had already been made. The engagement was made as the first step of the marriage and considered to be an integral part of the marriage. When the engagement took place, the marriage was certain. And only death or divorce could destroy that relationship. We read, of course, about Joseph and Mary, which I don't need to turn with you to, in the first part of Matthew, where we read that the angel says, don't be afraid to take Mary, your wife, because Joseph was planning to divorce her, and he was going to divorce her privately. He wasn't going to make a public example of her, it says, but he was going to divorce her privately. Now, stoning, of course, probably was by this time replaced by divorce. We don't know all the particulars about that. There's no way that we can really understand all that happened between the time when this law was given. A lot of people say that probably this stoning for adultery was rarely used, and often divorce was substituted for it. That seems to be the situation. We have no evidence, no proof. Certainly, law was clear. But Joseph was about to divorce her, and it would take a divorce to break a marriage or an engagement. That shows you how clearly and plainly engagement was viewed as the beginning of the marriage, that it was just as sure, just as certain as it could be. So the interesting thing about this then is that the marriage, which required a divorce, did not begin with sexual union. This demonstrates in the plainest way possible when David and when the angel speak about the engaged woman as being the wife of the engaged man and that divorce has to break it, this makes it as plain as it could be, and that the penalty in the law was the same as for an actual marriage. Makes it as plain as it could be that marriage began with engagement. But that the full marriage, all the aspects of marriage were not entered into until the time when the marriage feast took place, and then following that, the sexual union began. But marriage began with engagement. Marriage itself began by the covenantal arrangement that took place at engagement. Now, we don't have any marriage ceremonies in the Bible. We have the closest thing to a marriage ceremony in the book of Tobit, however. I'll read you a little bit of that. But it's not typical because it's a speeded up and compressed kind of thing. You've got exceptions to the rule all over the place. You've got, for example, with most virgins, the marriage period lasted up to 12 months. It could be 9 months, 11 months, 12 months. I suppose everybody waited at least 9 months to be sure. But 12 months would be the outside figure. And the engagement period was, the marriage itself was sexually consummated within 12 months from the period of engagement. And then for a widow who was remarrying, it was about 3 months period of time after the engagement before the marriage itself took place. But here was kind of a compressed job where Tobit's son is... Tobias his son is going to get a wife, and he goes a long way off, and he has to do everything all quickly. But it's the closest thing we had to anything like a marriage ceremony back way back when. In Tobit 7:13, we read, "Then he called his daughter Sarah, and taking her by the hand, he gave her to Tobias to be his wife." There's kind of a formal taking her by the hand and giving her to him, saying, "Here she is. Take her according to the law of Moses, and take her with you to your father." And he blessed them. Next he called his wife Edna and took a scroll and wrote out the contract, and they set their seals to it. Then they began to eat. And did they eat? They ate for 14 days. There was a big feast, and it lasted and lasted. The parents back at home had thought that he had something had happened to him. They were all upset. But anyway, that's part of the story. You can read all about it in Tobit someday when you get excited about the Apocrypha. Now, there was something like that, a simple ceremony. Who knows exactly what took place at any given point. We have later kinds of ceremonies and all that. But some kind of a ceremony did take place. There are other indications about spreading a garment in the Bible that aren't altogether clear. You've got it in the Ruth, in Book of Ruth, where Ruth and Boaz are suddenly encounter one another as Boaz awakens and she asks him to spread his garment over her. And you've got that in the Book of Ezekiel in 16:18, where God speaks about becoming betrothed and engaged and spreading his garment over Israel as his betrothed. And there must have been some symbolism there about protection and taking under one's care. They're very much into that question that could be discussed, but I don't want to get into it in much more detail at this point. So we have very clearly then the engagement as a binding thing. Hosea may have a word or two that would be of value to us, too. Hosea 2. Verses 19 and 20. We have here God talking about betrothing. "I will betroth you to me forever." Notice that concept, olam. "I will betroth you to me forever." The betrothal was not subject to breaking. And here his wedding vows are renewed in this new betrothal. "And in righteousness and in justice, in love and in tender mercy, I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord," which is a covenantal phrase, which he is doing this in a covenantal way. Now, that's the second thing that I want to turn to now. This is a covenant of companionship that we're talking about here. In Proverbs 2, once again, in verse 17, in that passage that we were looking at earlier, where we noted the word companionship, we note that it says in 2:17, that she forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. Forgets the covenant of her God. And we have parallelism here, obviously, in this Hebrew poetry that equates the forsaking her companion with forgetting the covenant. So forsaking her companion is equivalent to forgetting or breaking, you might say, the covenant. And then you have the same concept, interestingly enough, in the book of Malachi and that other passage where we were talking about the matter of companionship. There we read, why? Because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been faithless, although she is your companion and your wife by covenant, or your companion out of a covenant, companion of covenant. So that this companionship was a covenantal companionship. And if you want a definition of marriage, you can put it in these words. It is the covenant of companionship. Two people do not covenant to live together in sexual union only, in marriage, that's part of the companionship, but they covenant to be companions to one another in order to meet one's need of loneliness. That's what marriage is all about. It's a covenant of companionship, and that covenant is made, as we see in the engagement, the covenant is made at the time of engagement. And it is not made by sexual union, but it is made by agreement, by covenanting, that I will meet your need for a companionship. And then eventually it is met in the sexual, physical way, but it is even begun to be met in other ways during the engagement period and certainly after the sexual union takes place when there is a fuller relationship of the two. What are some of these other things that are involved in marriage? That are involved in companionship. Well, it's right there in verse 18 of chapter 2 of Genesis, as well as in the latter part of that chapter. We read, I will make him a suitable helper, this one says. The word helpmeet, which has come into our language, is no word. That is simply two King James words that have been elided or mushed together to form a non-word. Because we really have two words, and there is no such thing as a helpmeet. You always have people around, meet my helpmeet kind of stuff, you know. But there ain't no such animal. In 1611, the word help was equivalent to what in 1978 is helper. We think we're always shortening our language, not always so. We have lengthened that word. Help meant helper. You can read about it in the list of gifts, for example, the helps, the gift of being a help or a helper, as we would say in modern English today. So she was to be a helper who is meet, M-E-E-T, who is meet for her husband. And that word meet, of course, is outdated too. And it means appropriate to, or who corresponds to, or who approximates. The word literally means to stand over against, to stand in front of and over against and to correspond to and to approximate. If I had two grapefruit up here today, and I were to take a knife and irregularly slice one and then irregularly slice the other in half and take a half of one grapefruit and try to mesh it and together with the half from the other grapefruit, I could not get the two to approximate each other exactly because the cuts would be different. But if I took two halves from the same grapefruit, either one of them, and so turned them around that they once again approximated each other and brought them together, they would fit exactly at every point. And that's the idea in this word. Kind of like the mirror image, almost. Except that the idea of completing, I think, also fills this out. There's a certain emptiness unless God himself fills it in the special case for those who are given the capacity to live the single life and who are singled out with this special gift from God. There is a need for the rest to be filled out by a companion who approximates the person at every point and thereby brings a fuller kind of life to that individual. My wife has made me a fuller and richer and bigger and deeper person than I would ever be otherwise. Superficial as I am still, think of how bad I'd be if she were not around. My wife has done wonderful things for me. She's given me a viewpoint on life which is a feminine viewpoint. I've only had a masculine viewpoint up until the time, I only had up until the time that I married her. I saw all of life in terms of fishing and frogs and muddy boots and grease and that kind of thing. But she brought lace curtains into my life. And so a whole new dimension on life has developed, you see, and a whole new way of looking at things has happened to me. She has filled me out and made me a fuller and deeper and richer and bigger kind of person as a result of it. And hopefully I've smeared a little grease and mud on her lace curtains too. So that's one way in which this companionship takes place. Helping is another way. That the two are united together in an effort. It's not that the person has to do to achieve what he has to achieve alone, but he has somebody to talk it over with, somebody to counsel him, somebody with whom he can let down his hair. And that comes out even more fully in the latter part of the verse of the chapter in verse 24, where it says, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." Our time's going so fast, but the one flesh has nothing to do specifically with sexual relations, as so often it is taken to mean. When God is going to destroy the earth later on in this book, in Genesis 7:17 and 8:21 and 9:11-15 and 16, where he talks about it afterwards, we read about his destroying all flesh. It doesn't mean he's just going to destroy the flesh and not the bones. That isn't the idea. The emphasis is not upon flesh or the physical as such, the body as such, but when he speaks about destroying all flesh, it's just the same as if we said today in our modern English, he's going to destroy every body, but we don't really emphasize the word body. All flesh is equivalent to our everybody, but we're not saying just the bodies and nothing else. We mean everybody, you know, that's what we mean, everybody. Or everyone, as we say. What I'm trying to say then is all flesh simply means every person. All persons, everybody. And we get that same kind of a phrase in Joel and in the quotation of Joel in Acts 2, and everybody understood it. I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. It wasn't the spirit was poured out only upon the skin or something. But it's that the spirit of God was poured out upon all kinds of people, not just Jews. And not just men, or not just adults, but he goes on to specify what kinds. Young men and maidens and all kinds of people and so on would do various things. So the Spirit would be poured out upon the whole kit and caboodle, what he's saying. Now, this is the idea here. When he says they become one flesh, he means they are becoming one person. And if we had time, we'd develop it from 1 Corinthians 6, where it talks about bringing the body together with a harlot, and they become one body, which is distinguished from one flesh. Then he also talks about one spirit in that passage. Take your own time and have fun with that someday. We won't get into it here. But a clear distinction is made that they are not one person, which the one flesh passage develops, but that they are simply one body when they come together as a harlot with a harlot in illicit sexual relationships. And in the Ephesians 5 passage, where this Genesis 2:24 passage is quoted, the argument is that if the husband does things to his wife that are a blessing to her, that he really blesses himself because they two are one person. It's not that he's simply blessing his own skin or something. Or it's not even speaking about sexual relations there particularly. It certainly includes, this one flesh certainly includes that. They become one person, but they become one person in every sense. Physically, intellectually, emotionally, all sorts of ways. I've even watched people who have lived together for a long while, they begin to walk the same way. They use the same phrases. There are sometimes when people who have lived together and become so close to each other, somebody will say, "Hey, you know about the other one?" Says, "Yeah." And they don't even have to say what. You know? They just kind of, they're on the same wavelength together, you know. And it's uncanny. It's unreal. It even happens with animals at times. Sometimes, you know, did you ever notice the kind of dogs that somebody picked up? They usually have the same kind of hair the guy has. Picked it up. But that's another question. But this one person relationship, this one person is what we ought to think about one flesh's meaning, means a relationship of intimacy where the two interpenetrate each other in all respects, physically, emotionally, intellectually, in all ways. Now we have a lot of people running around trying to fulfill themselves and find fellowship and closeness and relationship in little groups. And we have all these weekend group marathons and all that kind of garbage, where people come together and they try to find all kinds of relationships that they ought to be finding in their one close, intimate relationship of marriage. And it's because their marriages aren't intimate and they aren't close and they aren't interpenetrating each other, and they're living like two kids in parallel play under the same roof, that we have all this need for companionship that God developed within the marriage relationship. This is where that close relationship to somebody with whom you can let down your hair is to be. You see, right there in that marriage relationship. That's what it means when it says, both the man and the wife were naked and they felt no shame in each other's presence. It's not talking there about sex again. We misunderstand that. Nothing came between them and God. Nothing came between them and each other. Not even clothing. They were open and frank and honest and completely vulnerable and completely open intellectually, emotionally, physically, in every way to each other. Nothing stood between them. And that's the way it ought to be with a husband and wife. Nothing between them to keep them from being completely open with each other. This, all you read about in openness groups, won't do it. Here's the place for real openness. Here's the place for real frankness. Here's the place for real intimacy. Here's the place for real companionship. This is what God provided. This is the place to cultivate. And this is what we need to teach people about marriage in our society and in our churches today. It's not legalized sex. It is the answer to a man's need for companionship. So that then is what we're talking about here. And this help and this approximation of each other, and this kind of thing is something far bigger than what the animals have. There can be no intellectual stimulation. There can be no openness of thought and where you can share your needs and your fears and your problems and your heartaches and your sorrows and your ambitions and all the troubles and where you can go to somebody who, even though you're a mess and you know it and she knows it and she still cares about you, or he knows it and he still cares about you, and there's something deeper there than even the problems that can come into your life. That's what marriage is all about. Real companionship, real fellowship, real unity. And that's what we need to keep developing in our people in counseling, and start holding forth as the ideal and preaching, and start developing among people with whom we work. And until a couple has this in premarital counseling before their eyes, instead of some kind of superficial idea that this is what will develop a good marriage, the fact that two of us have the same fathers, both had the same kind of job, we're from the same socioeconomic level, we both like tennis, until they get the idea that there's something deeper here than can be in any other human and human relationship of all, until they see that this is the most intimate, the closest, the richest, the most fulfilling and developing opportunity that any human being has in a relationship with another human being, they will not understand what marriage is all about. That is the concept of companionship that we need to start building. And we need to start developing in our own lives to demonstrate to others. Okay, we'll close off at this point. All right, I want to try to clean up our discussion on marriage. I don't mean that in the wrong sense of cleaning it up. I don't think it's been dirty, but I'd like to end it and then go on to our major discussion of this course, divorce, which then we'll try to tie together with some of the things that we have been saying. Marriage in the Scriptures not only is the first institution, chronologically speaking, that God visibly gives to man in a form that is already institutionalized, but it also has a principal place in his life. It is very interesting to study, for instance, that second chapter of Genesis a little bit more thoroughly in terms of verse 24. When you're doing counseling, all of you who have been involved in counseling to any extent at all are aware of the fact that many problems arise over a man putting other people or other activities before his marriage spouse or his marriage activities. That's one of the reasons, not the only, I'm sure, but one of the reasons why in Genesis 24 we're told, for this reason a man shall leave his father and his mother and cling to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. God did not put a parent and child in the garden. That was not the first, most basic, most intimate, most enduring, most important human relationship. Children and parent relationships came second, not first. God put a man and his wife in the garden. That was the most basic relationship, not primarily or only because of the propagation of the human race. Certainly that was a factor involved. But as we saw yesterday, primarily to meet the problem of loneliness with the answer of companionship. And we saw that marriage was a covenant of companionship. Now, we don't call a parent-child relationship covenantal in the same sense. There is no such agreement that is solemnized in an act of some sort like the marriage act, where both parties enter into the covenant voluntarily in the sight of God. The baptismal act, of course, which I'm not going to discuss at this point, does cement a covenantal relationship between parent and child. But in this respect, until the child enters into that covenant many years later on, it is much one-sided. But here in marriage, we have a prime relationship established, the very relationship between the two people established by a covenant into which both enter. And this relationship between husband and wife, we are told here, is enduring. They shall cling, whereas the relationship between parent and child must be broken. He shall leave father and mother. Leaving and cleaving are essential elements to contrast in this verse. And the contrast is intended in every sense. It is underscored in the passage. And the fact that the husband and wife become one person is so strongly emphasized in the verse, and the fact that the parent and child become two persons by the fact that they leave one another is thereby implied. And so we see a prime relationship and a secondary relationship before us in this verse. And unless we teach our people these contrasts, then we're going to have the same kind of problems, destroying marriages and leading to divorces and people remarrying who already have followed the wrong courses and the wrong directions, and then getting themselves once again bollocksed into the same kind of difficulties. We're going to have these things occurring again and again in our homes around us. When a husband and wife do not enter into an intimate relationship, such as we were discussing yesterday, in which the two become one person and they become open to one another with utter frankness, in which they do not have anything between them, the ideal that we saw that God gave for husband and wife as we talked about it yesterday. Unless that is realized more and more and is a growing thing and can only, of course, be realized in any genuine sense among Christians, because only they have the power of God to overcome the sin that separates people. But unless that is continually growing and continually emphasized in the marriage relationship, the tendency will be in this world of sin with people who still have tendencies towards sin in all directions. The tendency in each person of that marriage relationship will be to gravitate to other secondary relationships to try to find the satisfactions that they are not finding in meeting the problem of loneliness in the companionship that is not existent in the marriage. The mother, because she spends so much time with the child, with the children in the home, will tend to gravitate toward the children. Particularly, it seems, that a mother gravitates toward a strong son as he grows and tries to find her satisfactions in those children, particularly in that son, that she ought to be finding in her husband, particularly if he's gone a lot or if he doesn't give to her the kind of relationship or she can't seem to achieve in that kind of relationship with him, what the Scriptures is talking about here in this openness and this trust and so on. The husband, on the other hand, will tend to gravitate toward his work and perhaps eventually toward a secretary at his work. But he will gravitate toward that which he spends most of his time with during the day. And you'll find him staying out later and later, not necessarily because of the secretary, but maybe because he finds more satisfaction in burying himself in the work than he does in going home and having the strained relationships or the cold relationships or the non-companionship relationships that exist in his home. She, on the other hand, begins to turn more and more in dependence upon her boy as he grows, and an unhealthy relationship between the two of them continues to develop until the place where something tragic happens someday. Now, something tragic may happen before the children leave the home. It may happen because of the husband down at work and finding other people at work with whom he deals easier to live and even more open in some respects than his wife at home. And also, something may happen at that time when the children leave home or just before that boy leaves home. But at either point, these are crisis points in a marriage that we look for and we try to work with in our counseling. And one of the real answers to that problem, when we're trying to straighten things out and we've brought about reconciliation, let us say, and a desire to do something about the problem, one of the real answers lies in this verse. And we have to turn people to this verse and to the fuller outworking of this verse that we find in Ephesians, Colossians, and many other places, Titus, in the New Testament. But in the verse, the principle is explicit, that the man leaves and he cleaves. Now, when the mother-in-law at the time of marriage tries to hold on to her son selfishly, because this is the person in whom she finds those satisfactions or is trying to find, she never really can do so. She may find a few more temporary satisfactions than in a husband who's away or who's cold or something of that sort. But where she tries to find her satisfactions in that husband, in that son that she ought to have found in her husband, then a tremendously difficult situation begins at that marriage. First of all, it probably begins before the marriage. As soon as she begins to realize that that son is becoming serious about marriage, she begins to try to throw cold water on it. She begins to hang on to that son instead of letting him leave, instead of encouraging him to leave, instead of having built him throughout the years toward the idea that he's going to have to get out of here and he's going to have to run his own home and that we're looking forward to that day so that I could be alone with my husband. It's been nice to have you kids around here, but man, I can't wait to the day when I don't have to share you guys with him and I can be full time with him, you know. Instead of that kind of an attitude, it's a weepy, wary attitude. Oh, I don't want to let go of you. What's it going to be like when you leave home? And that kind of thing. You can always tell right at that point what's happening in the home because of the attitude that that mother has toward the young people and how serious they're getting outside. When she realizes that it's serious, usually around the engagement period, when the boy is talking about it, that's when she begins to throw the wrench into the machinery. She begins to throw the grit into the gears. And you begin to see things happening. She starts to criticize that gal. She's not good enough for my son, kind of attitudes begin to grow and come into the picture and so on. And you begin to get these kinds of clashes. But what's really beneath it, in most instances of this sort, though there can be exceptions, of course, maybe she isn't worth marrying or something. I mean, you know, there are rare exceptions. But where it's the wife and not the husband, and the husband's still a pretty decent guy and has pretty good judgment, and you see the wife especially struggling with this, you can almost always be sure that this is what we're working with. Here's a woman who hasn't recognized the truth that she must let her boy leave and that he must indeed cleave, that he's got to make a break with her and he's got to make a union with his wife. Not just the physical union, but a union in every respect, and particularly the physical is not what we're talking about at this point, but it's a union of communion. And so you see this kind of a struggle going on. And if the man, the young man who is getting married, allows this to happen, then all kinds of tragedies occur during that courtship and engagement and courtship and engagement period. After the marriage, even at the time of the marriage, you see all kinds of terrible things happen right at the marriage ceremony and in the days immediately following. And there'll be a dark cloud hanging over that marriage from the beginning, with all kinds of hurts and all kinds of crying and all kinds of tears, all kinds of strains and struggles that are going on that are unnecessary. Now, there are enough difficulties in establishing a new marriage, let alone to have that kind of thing hanging over your head from a mother-in-law who has not recognized the truth that she must let go of her child and allow a break to take place, and that he must become give his first allegiance no longer to his parents but now to his wife. And that's what you see happening so often in this kind of situation. And I emphasize that side of it rather than the work side because that's not mentioned in the passage, and it doesn't particularly have to do with the point that I want to make at this stage, though the work thing could be quite as serious too. So in our counseling, we need to be very much alert to the fact that sinners do not follow God's word, and this is one of the places where that failure to follow leads to great tragedies and great difficulties in marriage and can often be the prime factor in leading to a divorce and can often be the prime factor in the failure of a marriage. That the man, for instance, has allowed himself to be held by one hand, to be pulled by one hand by his mother and to be pulled by the other hand by his wife, and he's saying, who do I please? How do I please them both? Here are all these women. Well, the answer is very simple as far as he's concerned. He's got to gently but firmly and honestly and straightforwardly say to his mother, Mom, I love you, but I have to love my wife more. And that's what he has to say. And that's what he has to demonstrate in his decisions and in his actions. And in the long run, it will be better for her. It will be better for him. It will be better for his wife. And, of course, it will honor God. Now, he makes a break, but he should make a clean break when he leaves home. If he has said wrong things, if his attitude has been wrong, and in this world of sin, how often do we go through such tragic situations as young people who are just learning so many things anyway without saying or doing some wrong things, then he needs to square all that off with his parents. But if his attitude is right toward them, then he can go with a clean conscience into this new marriage and he can begin to bolster that oneness which needs to develop. One of the greatest tragedies in marriages today is the failure to recognize this leaving and cleaving dynamic, and the failure of counselors in premarital counseling to emphasize it and to insist that in all of the decisions and actions beginning before the wedding, but particularly as they come out in the wedding, whose views and whose ideas are going to be honored, mother-in-law's ideas about the wedding or the wife's ideas and that kind of thing, you see. And as long as they're not extravagant and, you know, put people into terrible debts. But these kinds of things are the beginnings of this break that needs to be made. This attitude is essential, and this way of moving is absolutely essential because the man has to become not only the head of a new decision-making unit before God, and therefore he cannot take orders from his father or from his mother any longer and put the burden of responsibility upon them as he did when he was a child in that home in making decisions that were not clear-cut and plain in the Word of God but demanded the secondary application of principles of the Word. But now he must make those secondary applications, and he must be responsible for those decisions as the head of a new home. That's, of course, a tremendously important factor, and one of the reasons why the husband is mentioned in the passage before us, rather than the wife also being mentioned, though, of course, implied in the passage, but primarily mentioning in this passage the husband. That's one of the main reasons why, because he must become the responsible party who is responsible for all of the decisions that are made in that home, since he is the head of a new decision-making unit called a home or a family, but also because he must now, as well as his wife, enter into what God has provided for him in this new dimension of companionship that he has never known before, never can know in any other relationship, and which is the greatest privilege of his marriage, the most wonderful thing that God has provided for him. This is what he is now to enter into, and anything that keeps him from becoming completely united so that he becomes one flesh with that wife is a hindrance to it. Any ties or any allegiances or any kind of relationship in the past that might somehow or other siphon off some of that fullness of that relationship and companionship in marriage that leads to this one person nest with his wife needs to be broken, needs to be severed. And the closest human ties that he has ever had up until this point is with his father and with his mother. And so they are explicitly mentioned in the passage. And it is with them that ties must be broken. Not that all ties, of course, must be broken, but all such intimate ties and all such relational ties and all such authoritative ties as have existed before, so that now he becomes the authority responsible to God for his home, and he becomes, he turns around in an entirely different direction toward an entirely new person. He enters into a deeper relationship than he could ever sustain to his father or mother in the past. Now, that is what we have to keep emphasizing when we're talking with people in marriage, when we get young people's groups or high school student groups or junior high. That's where you start training for marriage, in junior high, not in high school. I won't go into that. I did a little bit of that in Shepherding God's Flock, one of the Bibles, I forget which. But there's this whole thing in there that I try to emphasize that I think is so critical today, that you don't start training people after their ideas are set. Then you have to train against wrong ideas. And high school is where in our churches we think we ought to start training people for marriage because it's high schoolers who are starting to get married, or right after that they get married. No, the ideas for high schoolers start getting set while they're still at junior high. Of course, some of their ideas are set a little bit early, but they're really starting to think seriously about them in junior high, and they're still plastic, and they're beginning to think for themselves in the junior high period. And this is the most critical period of teaching of all. And when they've got their all the wrong ideas set in high school, that's not the time to come along and try to crack a lot of wrong ideas and a lot of peer pressure that's already been established. But while they're still floating around and the eyes are beginning to open up to this great and glorious world around them, and girls and boys and that kind of thing. Of course, the girls start 3 or 4 years before the boys, but the boys are starting to see that there are girls out there as well as frogs and that kind of thing. And that's the time to hit them. That's the time to go after them and to start to formulate those ideas on a scriptural basis and to start to get these ideas across. Of course, you should start doing it a lot earlier even than that in some ways. Whenever I get a bunch of little kids together and talk to a lot of little kids, and I talk to them about family relationships or something, one of the things I like to say to little kids is something like this. I say, who's the most important person in your home? Yeah. And they all say, no, you're not the most important person in your home. I'm not. No. Your home will be there when you're gone.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Who's the most important person in your home? Your mom and your dad are the most important people in your home. And what's done ought to be done for them first and for you second. They shouldn't live for you. You ought to be living in that home for them. And we have to start straightening out those ideas right from the beginning with those little tackers, you know, to let them know what the relationship is. So when you get an opportunity like that, go after them, you know. And tell them what to do and who's what and what the relationships are. You know, you're only going to be here for a few years, 18, 19, 20 years, 21 years or something in this home. Your parents got to live there for years and years and years after that, just like they did before you ever came around. And the home's going to go on. You're going to be gone. And we got to start saying to young marrieds from the very beginning when they got little tackers, you see, from the very beginning when they start training that kid to get out of here. God's just put him here for a while. Right. When they're in arms like this, get that kid ready to leave. Because that's their whole job. Their whole job is to train that kid to keep him from killing himself during the years through, you know, swings and and baseball and football out there to try to preserve him. And they got to feed him to keep him alive. And they got to train him toward something. Not just train him, but train him toward something. And they all always be thinking from the very beginning when that child is born, I got to train him to leave and be the head of his own home or to be a wife in somebody else's home. And I want to train them toward that. And they ought to always be pushing that kid. Now, I don't mean too fast, too hard, but they ought to always, in a sense, be shoving him to keep him from making roots with his parents or roots in the home or thinking that the home situation is ultimate. It's temporary. It must be broken. And the other one must be continuous. Now, with people who have the gift, who are the exception, who have the gift of singleness, even they have to make a break of a sort. And because the parent's eventually going to die, and probably before he or she does. So you've got to even train them to be independent of the parents, too. And so, you know, this cannot go wrong when we start training from the beginning with those ideas in mind. And the problem is that most parents suddenly, not thinking this way, most kids suddenly, because they've not been thinking this way, arrive at the point where marriage occurs or is about to occur, and suddenly all the tugs and all the ties, with no previous thinking, no previous planning, no discussion of the matter, no preparation of it, or all these previous ties suddenly converge, and there's a terrible struggle that takes place. And the guy feels guilty because his mother's over here crying, and you didn't think about me when you made this decision. The two of you went over to her mother's, her father's place for Thanksgiving. It didn't come to mind, and you haven't been here. All this kind of stuff. And he feels awful, and he feels guilty, you know, about all this stuff because she's pouring it on him. And he hasn't thought clearly about it, and she hasn't thought clearly about it. She shouldn't be pouring it on him, and he shouldn't be accepting it and feeling guilty if he's done the right thing before God and his wife. And so he's got to put his wife first among all other relationships. She has to put her husband first among all other human relationships under God. All relationships are under God. I never put God in the list. Some people put God first, wife and husband second. I don't do that. God's not in the list. God's over all the relationships. And so I never put him in the list. I put him over the whole smear. But it's God, it's husband and wife first. It's children second, family second, and parents second. And it's job third in the scriptures. Always in Ephesians, Colossians, and Titus. That's the order. And so whenever you get that messed up or mixed up or something out of order or the improper relationship's going, you're in trouble. And we've got to start developing that kind of consciousness in the people with whom we work. And it's one of the great factors in divorce, and it's one of the great factors in healing and bringing about reconciliation. There are probably more, you know, you don't, whenever you hear the jokes on television or whenever you read the cartoons in the paper, what you have is one thing. You have jokes about the fellow's mother-in-law. That's the joke that you're always running into. But that isn't the one that you ever run into in counseling. Well, you do, but rare. The one you run into is the woman, the wife, and her mother-in-law. And that's such a serious hair-pulling situation that nobody dare make a joke over that one. That's why that one doesn't get into the cartoons. That's why that one doesn't get into the television joking. Because there's no joke about it. That is a rough deal. And you've got two women pulling the same guy to pieces, and he's allowing it. And that's what we've got to watch out for. So I want to alert you to that serious problem, and it comes right out of the basics and the elements of marriage, and it's one of the factors that has to be dealt with continually. All right? Now, the principal place then of the marriage relationship. And the last factor I'd like to just mention today, once more, I hit on it very briefly yesterday, but I'd like to develop it just a little bit, is this concept of compatibility. We hear so much about compatibility today. Wherever you turn, and you read about it in books and marriage counseling and so on, I think we need to train people that nobody is compatible. There ain't no such thing as compatibility in a world of sinners. Everybody is incompatible. Some more so than others, perhaps. But everybody is incompatible. You cannot put two sinners under the same roof in an intimate relationship. Two sinners who grew up developing sinful patterns separately in different contexts and have peace, harmony, joy, and happiness 24 hours a day. Maybe 8 hours a day. While they're asleep, if they can sleep that long. But that's about it. Because as soon as you get two active sinners at work in a home on the problems and the situations and on each other, you've got problems galore. And marriage, one of the key factors in marriage, is developing answers to all of life's exigencies that this home will give, answers that usually are not going to be identical to the answers that he and his home learn to extend, or the answers that she and her home learn to extend to life's problems, toward life's problems, but are going to be, in many respects, a new and third kind of answer. And that means change. And change never comes easily to anyone of us sinners. We always tend to resist change. We always tend to fight it. We always tend to fight for what is comfortable and habitual, because we're lazy creatures and we're also fearful creatures, and change means the unknown and it means effort. And those things are not easy for people to do. And sometimes we make stupid commitments and we say this is the right way without having thought it through, and then we try to stand behind those stupid commitments like we were uttering the laws of the Medes and the Persians. But the point of this is that where you have two people under the same roof who are still sinners, even though in Christ they are perfect, they have not yet realized that perfection in this world, and they're still at the process of sanctification and still plenty of room to go, you're going to have difficulty in that home. And we need, of course, to make that extremely clear to young people in marital counseling. And, whenever you're doing marital counseling, just a word or two on this, whenever you're doing marital counseling, you usually have people, this is not always so, sometimes it's very wonderful, but usually you have people who have stars in their eyes. And they have the idea that anything you tell them about difficulties that are going to come is for somebody else, but it certainly couldn't be the two of them. Why, this is the Anthony and Cleopatra of the latter days. And, as you sit there and you talk about these difficulties to come and what to do about them and all that, and he's got his arm around her on the surface, and he kind of looks at her and she looks at him. They're kind of giggling inside, saying to each other by that giggle and letting you know, I'm sure that's true of many people, but not of us. Look at her. Why, she's just perfection itself, and look at him. Isn't he glorious? And, there they are. Or maybe more frequently she's thinking, yeah, he's got problems, but I'll handle it. And or something like that, But they've got it made. One way or another, it's set and it's made. And it's only about 2 months or three down the pike after the marriage takes place that the stars rise out of the eyes and they're over the head. And then you can begin to do a little marital counseling. So the most important thing you do, other than the qualifying for marriage counseling, that's about all that's really useful in many cases in premarital counseling, but if you've qualified them for marriage, the most important thing you do in premarital counseling is set up the postmarital counseling dates. And that's really critical. I don't want to go into that because I've gone into it in books somewhere in the shepherding series, and you can get into that a little more fully if you like to later on. But that really is the most important thing. Compatibility, then, is something we have to work at dispelling from people's minds. There are just two factors that we want to emphasize most strongly in talking about who is fit to marry another person, who is fit for you and who are you fit for. And that is, first of all, the absolute essential that the two of you are Christians. And I don't need to go into that. I'm sure all of you are aware of that and can develop it on your own without much difficulty. But then I always add a second factor. It's not compatibility whether the two of you grew up in the same social set or whether your fathers left the door at precisely 6:30 a.m., slammed it in harmony, walked to the corner and got on the same bus, both carrying a briefcase in the right hand, both with gray flannel pinstripe suits, and both got off the bus at the same time in the afternoon, and both went out of the backyard and burned the food on the charcoal burner the same way, whether you had the same socioeconomic backgrounds. That isn't what makes two people compatible, but you work at being compatible by this second factor. And this is what really qualifies two people who are Christians for marriage. All other disqualifying factors out of the way. And it's this. Have the two of you been able to demonstrate, not just assert, but demonstrate in your relationship thus far, that when problems arise, as they certainly must have already, and they certainly will continue to throughout the rest of your married lives, that when problems arise, you have been able to demonstrate that the two of you not only are willing to, but are capable of and have in fact actually done the following. You have been able to turn to God's Word and prayerfully find together the solutions to your problems in that book. When you've got two people who have been able to demonstrate that they're not only Christians, but that they are Christians who are willing to submit their wills to the will of God expressed in the Word of God, and that they are willing to find out the answer, regardless of what they think, they are willing to find out the answers to their problems in that book, and the two of them have demonstrated that they have been able to do so together, and you've got a viable situation. Those two can make a marriage of it. I don't care what other factors may be similar or different in their backgrounds. That's the one thing that they've got to have in order to make a go of it as Christians in their marriage. Because problems there will be. Problems there will be galore. And what they do to face those problems, how they handle them, is the most critical, most crucial thing of all. All other factors are preferential factors. I don't care about anything else. Doesn't matter whether they're yellow, blue, green, black, orange, white, or pink. That doesn't matter. Doesn't matter whether one was a prince and the other was a pauper. Doesn't matter whether one likes tennis and the other one likes fishing. All those problems, all those differences, all those things can be resolved if this second factor is active. That's the critical factor. Now, people have a right to preferential situations. You don't have to take the first Christian who comes down the pike with whom you find that you're able to work out problems God's way. You don't have to take that person as your husband or wife necessarily. Everything else is preferential, and there's a certain room for preferential factors according to the Scripture. It talks about people looking at somebody and, you know, kind of, she's a nice-looking gal. That's a factor, but it's not a prime factor. But these are the two essentials, and I think if we're talking to people who are either talking about remarriage or marriage and doing these things, this is one of the critical things to emphasize. Not compatibility elements, but what is it that will eventually make people compatible? That second element is the thing. Now we're going to turn to divorce. Get started on this thorny issue with the background now that we have sketched about some few principles concerning marriage. And I want to emphasize to you that we're not talking about marriage in this course. We're just talking about a few principles of marriage that are basic to divorce and remarriage counseling. And we'll try to show how some of these come into play as we go along.
Dr. Adams continues this series on divorce and remarriage in the following cassette.